In Britain, where conditions deteriorated less than in any other belligerent country during the war, and where commitment to it remained relatively high, there were more strikes than in any other warring nation, except Russia. Three times as many British workers went on strike in 1918 as in 1914. Outside Britain, strikes were relatively few in the first two war years, but then grew sharply in number and with increased political content in 1917-18. As the seemingly endless suffering and hardship of the war intensified, so did the search for scapegoats held to blame for the misery. Popular hatreds were fanned by state propaganda. Grassroots resentment was widely directed at capitalists and financiers. But this wasn't merely the obvious class hatred of war profiteers. It could also be diverted with little difficulty into race hatred. Jews were increasingly caricatured as exploiters of the toiling masses, as the embodiment of finance capital. Hatred of Jews was, however, too long-standing among much of Europe's population, and too chameleon-like in adapting its colours to any prejudice to be confined to a linkage only with capitalism. Deep antipathy often blended economic resentment with age-old prejudice against Jews, still very prevalent, notably in Central and Eastern Europe, and often promoted by Christian clergy, as the killers of Christ. To this amalgam of hatreds was added another lethal ingredient in 1917, the Jews as a cause of Bolshevism and revolution. The multifaceted image of the Jew as the war approached its end defied parody. Enemy of Christianity, capitalist exploiter, shirker of military duty, fomenter of internal unrest, driving force of Bolshevism. It was little wonder that a pre-war forgery of the Tsarist police purporting to show a Jewish conspiracy aimed at world power, the so-called Protocols of the Elders of Zion, increased its circulation sharply after 1917, as the backlash against the Russian Revolution began. Changes in the society of each belligerent country were both affected by, and in turn, directly influenced, the effect of the war on domestic politics and the viability of the respective state system. At first, states tried to keep their political systems running as before the war, or as close to it as possible. Business as usual was a slogan coined in Britain by Winston Churchill in a speech in November 1914 to underline the need for continued normality, undisturbed by hostilities abroad that were expected to be of short duration. Such hope was to have a brief lifetime in every belligerent state. But politics, more or less as usual, continued until the states became, to a greater or lesser extent, internally buffeted by the pressures of war. In Britain and France, party political differences were unabated and often sharp, but didn't override a sense of unity produced by commitment to the war effort, a unity challenged only by minorities who were at times vocal, though without mainstream influence. Where change took place here, it was after periods of adversity to put strong men in charge of government, to prosecute the pursuit of victory with relentless vigour. Following the huge losses at the Somme, and in the wake of a serious rebellion in Ireland that threatened British rule on the island, the dynamic David Lloyd George became British Prime Minister in December 1916, at the head of a small but powerful war cabinet. His leadership succeeded in bringing new organisation and drive to the war economy, and in galvanising the war effort. In France, political crisis after the Troubles of 1917, serious mutinies at the front, strikes, anti-war demonstrations and demands for a compromise peace at home, led to the recall to government in November of that year of the veteran radical leader Georges Clemenceau. A symbol of republican nationalism, he was appointed to embody energetic commitment, restore confidence, and symbolized the stubborn and patriotic struggle for a victor's peace. In neither Britain nor France did internal disputes over the running of the war and varying levels of social and political disaffection, mainly on the socialist left, come closer to a revolutionary challenge to the state. British morale at home was sustained in good measure by the confidence that the country wouldn't be invaded, the prospect of victory and a relatively low level of material privation. Indirectly, the war, of course, affected everyone. But its direct effect was largely confined to those in military service. Attitudes in France were more divided. Pacifist protests and demonstrations for peace in early 1918, in which expressions of support for Bolshevism and revolution were voiced, led to a big strike of munitions workers in May. Such views might have been more widely held had the war not been fought on French soil. As it was, pacifism was more than countered by the urgency of fighting on to withstand the major German offensive. Once that had faded and victory was in sight, French morale held up to the end. Overwhelmingly, in both Britain and France, the socialist left continued its support for the war effort. In neither country was there a serious threat to the legitimacy of the state itself. It could have been different here too, had defeat loomed and the losses been viewed as in vain. At the opposite end of the spectrum to the Western powers was Russia. Only in Russia was there a revolution during the war itself. Only in Russia did the revolution amount to a root and branch transformation of socio-economic relations, as well as political structures. And only in Russia was the ruling class utterly destroyed. The attempted Russian Revolution in 1905 had failed because there had been no cohesion to link the discontents of striking workers, rebellious peasants, and those of soldiers and sailors, only a relatively small number of whom mutinied. There had been a lack, too, of unifying revolutionary leadership. The Tsar had bought off the revolution, partly through concessions towards constitutional government that soon proved to be little more than cosmetic. Repression did the rest. The Tsarist political police, the Okhrana, was efficient in arresting revolutionary leaders or banishing them to remote exile, infiltrating their organizations, closing down seditious newspapers, putting down strikes, and executing peasant rebel leaders. The regime had for now staved off its destruction. Over the following years, communications were improved, the economy grew, in the last pre-war years at a faster rate than the United States. Big advances were made in industrialization, and state revenues were increased. But the big problem remained, the sclerotic nature of the Tsarist autocracy. Perhaps without the war, changes could have been introduced that would have transformed Tsarist rule into a parliamentary-controlled constitutional monarchy. This seems unlikely, however, given the stiff-necked resistance to systematic change in the ruling class and the extent of ingrained and organized, whatever the repression, hostility to the autocracy among the working class and peasantry. A revolution was more probable than not at some future point. By late 1916, it was looking likely in the near future. During the bitter winter of 1916-17, while many Russian peasants hoarded food or sold it at high prices, the big industrial centres had suffered from an acute shortage of provisions and fuel. Transport was close to collapse. The state finances were in ruins. Inflation was rampant. Wages, apart from those as skilled munitions workers, couldn't keep pace with galloping prices. Many people were near starvation. But a privileged minority was still doing well out of the war, a source of intense resentment. Big protest strikes in January 1917 took place in Petrograd, formerly St. Petersburg, and other cities in which anger about living standards was linked to anti-war feeling and opposition to Tsarist rule. When working women took to the streets on the 8th of March, the 23rd of February in the old Russian calendar, to protest that they had no bread, it sparked mass strikes and demonstrations by armaments workers. Soldiers and sailors supported the workers' insurrection in Petrograd. Firing on demonstrators in Petrograd couldn't end the strike of over 200,000 workers, and the government was powerless to defuse what was tantamount to a growing military strike within the armed forces. Orders to suppress the mutinies fell on deaf ears. The situation rapidly ran out of the control of the Tsarist authorities. In conditions of anarchy, workers elected their own form of representative government, a Soviet or council. Order rapidly collapsed. The soldiers also elected Soviets to represent them, demanding the removal of the Tsar. When leading officers and politicians agreed that the Tsar had to go, he went, abdicating on the 15th of March. He and his family would be shot by the Bolsheviks in July 1918, though their bodies were only identified 80 years later, after the end of the Soviet Union. The war had produced the conditions whereby the burning anger directed at the Tsar and the system of rule he represented, which was held to blame for their misery, transcended for the time being the divided interests of workers and peasants. The revolutionary forces in the industrial working class in 1917 temporarily linked with those among the peasantry. Even together, these may have proved insufficient to topple the system, as had been the case in 1905, but crucially, the war allied their interests with those of the growing numbers of massively disaffected troops at the front. Once the disaffection spread to the front, once the soldiers were unwilling to fight any longer, and once their revolutionary fervour blended with that of the home front, the regime was living on borrowed time. The groundswell of discontent at the enormous losses and unbearable hardships coalesced into an explosion of opposition to the war that swept away the system held to blame for it. A regime that had relied upon repression and coercion, with few intermediary structures to integrate the mass of the population into unenforced support for it, found itself with hardly any friends as the pressures mounted before the dam walls burst in 1917. Even after the deposition of the Tsar and the establishment of the Provisional Government of Revolutionary Democracy in March 1917, the situation remained highly unstable. The fluid conditions over the following months and the further prosecution of a war irredeemably lost created the climate in which a second, far more radical revolution could take place. By this point, in October 1917, in the old Russian calendar, the organizational framework available for channeling and leading the revolution was at hand. This proved, in contrast to 1905, a decisive factor in the success of this revolution. The Bolshevik Party had as yet no mass base outside small parts of the working class, but it did have a tightly knit fanatical leadership core with a preconceived program that saw the destruction of the old system not as an end in itself, but as merely the prelude to the building of an entirely new society. The Bolshevik Party had emerged as the larger faction of the divided Russian Social Democratic Labour Party, which had been founded in 1899, but had later split into a larger revolutionary Bolshevik and a smaller reformist Menshevik wing. Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, better known by his sobriquet Lenin, who had been exiled to Siberia in the late 1890s, and had then lived mainly outside Russia until 1917, had envisaged the party as the vanguard of the working class and advocated tight discipline and complete loyalty behind the aim of overthrowing the Tsar. Lenin's next objective was to establish, through ruthless deployment of terror against class enemies, a provisional revolutionary democratic dictatorship of the proletariat and peasantry. In April 1917, the charismatic Bolshevik leader had been transported from his Swiss exile to the revolutionary chaos of Petrograd by the Germans, who were hoping to undermine the wavering Russian will to continue fighting by fomenting further unrest and agitation for peace. In the light of later events, it was one of the great own goals of history. Amid government repression of the Bolsheviks, Lenin was forced to retreat in July to Finland, a semi-autonomous part of the Russian Empire since 1809, and after the toppling of the Tsar, voicing ever more strident demands for independence. But as state power evaporated, he returned to Petrograd to lead the Second Revolution. What bound the close-knit Bolshevik party leadership and its committed members together was a utopian ideology of salvation, the vision of a future classless society free of conflict. But what gave the Bolsheviks the potential to reach out to a wider constituency was less ethereal and more pragmatic. The promise of peace, bread, distribution of land, ownership, and control of the factories, and law in the hands of the people. Politically, the Bolsheviks demanded all power to the Soviets, which had meanwhile been set up in all the major cities. The unpopularity of Alexander Kerensky's provisional government amid further acute shortages, rocketing inflation, and huge bloodshed in the last disastrous offensive played into the hands of the Bolsheviks. Control of the Petrograd Soviet, run by Leon Trotsky, born Lev Davidovich Bronstein, a gifted organizer and demagogue who preached the need for permanent revolution, provided the launchpad for the October Revolution, which eventually led to the complete Bolshevik takeover of the Soviets. It would require ruthless internal terror against class enemies and over 2 years of the most brutal civil war imaginable before the powerful forces of reaction and counter-revolution were defeated and Russia was set firmly on the path to complete political, social, economic, and ideological transformation. But it was plain from the start. The Bolshevik Revolution was an event of world historical significance. What it had produced was an absolutely new kind of state and society. Reports of what was happening in Russia sent shockwaves throughout Europe that would reverberate for decades. Elsewhere in Europe, the crisis of legitimacy came over a year after the Bolshevik Revolution, in the wake of looming defeat. In Germany, war didn't mean the end of party politics. On the contrary, the polarization of German politics, clearly established before the war but initially cloaked by the civil truce of 1914, became fully exposed as the feeling of hardship, huge human losses for scant return, and of impending defeat grew. The ideological and class divisions that had been only temporarily glossed over at the beginning of the war soon resurfaced, and from 1916 onwards in sharply radicalized form. As food supplies dwindled, prices increased sharply and living standards plummeted. The political divisions over peace or annexationist war aims intensified. The main drive for drastic political change came from German left-wing elements. The Social Democrats had split in April 1917 over their stance towards the war. A radical minority who rejected the war as an imperialist conflict that could only be overcome by socialist revolution broke away and formed the Independent Social Democratic Party of Germany, the USPD, the core of which later became Germany's Communist Party. The larger body of Social Democrats, now calling themselves the Majority Social Democratic Party of Germany, MSPD, also condemned an imperialist war and German annexations, but they rejected revolution in favour of reform through the introduction of representative democracy, of government responsible to Parliament, not to the Kaiser. In Imperial Germany, political parties across the spectrum were representative in the Reichstag. But they didn't control decision-making. Power lay in the hands of the Kaiser and of his appointed ministers and military leaders. On the 19th of July 1917, the MSPD was supported by some liberals, the Progressive People's Party and the Catholic Centre Party, in voting for a peace resolution in the Reichstag. But they faced powerful opponents on the conservative and liberal right wing who backed the military leadership and favoured not only the uncompromising prosecution of the war, but also the drive for further territorial annexations. Pressure groups backed by big business finance, such as the Pan-German League and especially the huge, rabidly nationalist and imperialist Fatherland Party, founded in 1917, and rapidly acquiring the backing of 1.25 million members, popularized the case for fighting on to victory with extended territorial gains, and at the same time they rejected demands for parliamentary democracy. This political constellation remained in place down to the end of the war, intensifying as material hardship worsened and as defeat loomed. The radical polarization of German politics that followed the defeat in 1918 was already prefigured in the internal developments of the last two war years. It was, however, only in the last few months of the war, after the failure of the summer offensive of 1918, that morale at the front collapsed, adding to the growing pressure at home to halt the fighting. Major strikes by German industrial workers in January 1918, had met with little sympathy at the front, where soldiers had been led to expect success in the spring offensive. The mood among the troops had been exultant at this elementary expression of German strength when the big offensive was launched in March. When the realization dawned that it had failed, the welling anger started to turn into direct action. More than anything, soldiers who had fought with courage and conviction for almost 4 years wanted to survive what they now saw to be a hopeless contest. War weariness turned into a mounting desire simply to stop fighting. In the last 4 months of the war, 385,000 German soldiers surrendered on the Western Front, far more than in the previous 4 years of the war taken together. An estimated 750,000 soldiers deserted from August 1918 onwards. This blended into the growing unrest at home. In the huge strikes early in the year, workers' protests had been mainly about living conditions. Now, they had an unmistakably political edge. The demand was increasingly for peace, democracy, and an end to the Kaiser's regime. The longer the war went on, the more the nature of the German state itself had been called into question. The political system, where ministers were responsible to the Kaiser, not to Parliament, had already been rejected by socialists before the war, but was upheld by strong forces that resisted any move towards democracy. Worsening war fortunes resulted in a growing clamour on the left, not simply to end the relentless bloodshed, but to remove those held responsible and to introduce democratic parliamentary government. More and more Germans saw a system of rule resting upon militarism, class privilege, and unchecked power, embodied by the divisive figure of the Kaiser, a system that had taken Germany into a disastrous war, as unreformable. It had to be replaced. Democracy had to be established. The people who had borne the pain, suffering, and privations of the war had to have their political voice heard. By the autumn of 1918, the legitimacy of the state system in Imperial Germany had all but collapsed. The 14-point program that President Wilson had put forward the previous January, which foresaw, among other things, the restoration of territory that Germany had annexed or occupied, had previously been an anathema to Germany's leaders. In the rapidly changing circumstances, however, the newly appointed Reich Chancellor, Prince Max von Baden, who had personally long favoured political reform and peace without annexations, appealed on the 5th of October to Wilson, hoping for an armistice on terms amenable to Germany. Wilson would make no concessions, however, insisting on the introduction of parliamentary democracy, entailing the loss of power for Germany's ruling elites, renunciation of territorial gains, and significant disarmament, including the handing over of the fleet. There was heated debate among Germany's leaders about the acceptability of what they saw as harsh terms. Ludendorff vehemently proposed continuing the war rather than yield to such humiliation. But he was no longer in a position to issue commands, and events were galloping beyond his or anyone else's control. On the 26th of October, blaming all but himself, he resigned. During the night of the 29th to the 30th of October, mutineering sailors at Kiel defied the naval leadership's absurd orders for the fleet to put to sea to engage the British Navy in a last great showdown battle. This would have invited a senseless sacrifice for nothing but the honour of the German Navy. The sailors were having none of it. The mutiny rapidly spread and set the spark to full-scale revolution. Workers' and soldiers' councils sprang up, taking power at the grassroots into their own hands. The generals made plain to the Kaiser, the very symbol of the old order, that he had to go. Reluctantly, he went. During the night of the 9th to the 10th of November, Kaiser Wilhelm II left the military headquarters in Spa in Belgium for exile in Holland, where he would remain until his death in 1941. His abdication was announced prematurely, since his formal renunciation of the throne only followed on the 28th of November. Even before he departed, a republic had been hastily proclaimed from the balcony of the Reichstag in Berlin. Equally without actual constitutional legitimacy, the Chancellor, Max von Baden, appointed his own successor, the socialist leader Friedrich Ebert. Constitutional niceties didn't matter in the revolutionary moment. Germany was on its way, amid turmoil that would last for months, to the establishment of a fully fledged parliamentary democracy. Ominously, still powerful forces in the state, defenders of the old order, felt merely that they were biding their time, making necessary tactical adjustments, until different circumstances could sweep away the concessions to democracy and parliamentary rule. Just before the armistice, the view could be heard in the German military leadership that the parties of the left have to take on the odium of this peace. The storm of anger will then turn against them. There are hopes then of later vaulting back into the saddle and ruling again in the old way. Democracy was viewed in such circles as the greatest misfortune to befall Germany. In Italy, the growing crisis of the state system had been only slightly less profound than in Germany. Although Italy was on the side of the Entente, it didn't feel as if the war was being won. The war had been imposed upon a deeply divided country in 1915 by a narrow political elite, hoping after a quick victory for sizable territorial gains in the Adriatic. Even the generals had been kept largely in the dark about the decision to intervene, and Parliament hadn't been consulted. The majority of the population felt in any case that it had no stake in the existing limited political representation. Italians could drum up no enthusiasm for governments that changed frequently but always seemed the same, and to be looking after the same elite interests. Defeats, material hardship and heavy losses then polarised society and undermined support, not just for a succession of weak governments, but for the state itself. The Italian Parliament, symbolising the weakness and division, seldom met. Governments ruled by decree. Moreover, though bearing the blame for what went wrong, they were unable to control General Luigi Cadorna. the austere, domineering and brutal commander of the Italian army until the humiliation of Caporetto in 1917 forced his removal. Before then, military imperatives had prevailed. Factory discipline was subject to military control. Censorship and restrictions on freedom of speech were increased. Repression intensified as protests against shortages and strikes took place in factories. Social and political divisions were greatly sharpened and focused on the inequities as well as the horrendous casualties of the war. As losses, defeats, material shortages, and the sense of national humiliation mounted from 1916 onwards, unrest manifested itself in strikes, demonstrations, and protests at food shortages. It fell short of an outright revolutionary mood, but not by much. Opposition to the war and popular discontent was mostly voiced on the left, though the socialist movement was itself split between those who rejected the war outright and wanted revolution, and the majority who continued to provide patriotic, if unenthusiastic, support for the war effort. Ominously, the Italian government found itself even more vehemently attacked from the right. The nationalists extended the base of their support, increased their agitation for territorial expansion in southeastern Europe and Africa, and, so the Minister of the Interior claimed, sought to gain control of the police and terrorize their opponents. They wanted to sweep away what they saw as sterile parliamentary rule and its attendant bureaucracy, advocating radical social change through a state and economy to be run on quasi-military lines, even when the war was over. They were already at the forefront of the local defense formations that call themselves Fasci. Italy's post-war crisis was foreshadowed. The House of Habsburg, rulers of Austria for centuries, was now also bearing the price for an increasingly and massively unpopular war. The conflict, sparked by a dispute with Serbia that had become all but forgotten, had never enjoyed complete support from the beginning. It could scarcely be portrayed as a defensive war, and the dependency on Germany, even for whatever victories could be mustered, was too obvious to be comfortable. The centrifugal forces threatening to split and destroy the Habsburg Empire were hugely reinforced as a disastrous war ground on. The strains were telling long before the last catastrophic phase of the conflict. The aged Emperor Franz Josef had for decades been almost the sole symbol of unity in the enfeebled multinational empire, in which the Hungarian half was, in its institutional structures, already more or less a separate entity. When he died in November 1916, it was in the midst of a mounting crisis of legitimacy, both for the war effort and for the Habsburg throne. His grand-nephew and successor, Emperor Karl, had no chance of turning the tide, despite vain attempts to weaken the dependence on Germany and to seek a peace agreement with the Allies. Briefly, after Caporetto, the Austrians dreamt again of glory, but the trains that had almost exclusively ferried provisions for the army weren't available to transport fuel and food for the civilian population of the empire during the hard winter that followed. Huge protest strikes multiplied in various parts of the empire over the early months of 1918. Industrial unrest, anger at deplorable living conditions, nationalist separatist feeling, and anti-war disaffection blended in an unholy brew. Complete incapacity of the rulers, absolute demoralization and disorganization, general insecurity, was the view of the Viennese doctor and writer Arthur Schnitzler. By October 1918, as food riots, strikes, protests, nationalist enmities and lawlessness spread, the situation, in the judgment of the head of the Austrian Food Office, Hans Löwenfeld Rus, had become utterly desperate. The Habsburg Empire was visibly falling apart. Class divisions throughout much of the empire were in good measure subsumed into or overridden by the policies of ethnic nationalism. Outside the Austrian heartlands, where working-class protests at sharply deteriorating living standards threatened to develop into revolution, often taking inspiration from Russia, they were merged in demands for independence, for the dissolution of the empire that were increasingly voluble among Czechs, Poles, and South Slavs. In Hungary, despite the professed readiness of Emperor Karl to introduce liberal reforms and move to a more federally structured empire, pressure for independence from Vienna grew in the last war years, backed by socialists and many liberals. Unlike Hungary, where civilian rule and parliamentary debate had been at least nominally maintained, in the Austrian half of the empire, the legislature, the Reichsrat, had been suspended and provincial assemblies closed down. Censorship and surveillance were stepped up sharply. Military law was introduced into non-German and non-Czech lands. Dissidents were arrested and imprisoned, but repression proved insufficient to quell the rising nationalist separatist movements, particularly strident among the Czechs in the last war years. After the remnants of the Austro-Hungarian army, with little on their minds but saving their own skins, were routed by Italians at Vittorio Veneto in October 1918, the empire was on its last legs. The army now disintegrated. Emperor Karl agreed in late October to troops joining their own national forces. It was no more than a recognition of what was happening on the ground, as Czechs, Poles, Hungarians, Croats, and others deserted and left for home. By late October, with extraordinary speed, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and Yugoslavia were proclaiming their independence. Austria's armistice with Italy on the 3rd of November marked the end of its war effort. Emperor Karl reluctantly renounced his powers, though not his claim to the throne, on the 11th of November and spent the remaining 3 years of his life exiled in Switzerland and, finally, Madeira. 5 centuries of Habsburg rule were over. Revolution in Germany and in Austria-Hungary, the dismantling of their monarchies and replacement with republics, in the latter case in a number of successor states, took place only at the point of defeat in the war. The dismembering of the Ottoman Empire to the south of Turkey itself, most of the former possessions in the Balkans had gained independence in the 1870s, and the Balkan Wars of 1912 and 1913 brought the final loss of Ottoman territories in Europe, followed defeat when the wartime Turkish leaders had fled on board a German submarine for Odessa and eventually Berlin. Within the Ottoman Empire too, however, growing adversity to the war had caused an insurmountable crisis of state legitimacy. The high level of desertion pointed to an increasingly parlous state of morale in the Turkish army. The shaky and unwieldy Ottoman Empire had overstretched itself in its war effort. It came away empty-handed in its attempts to make territorial gains in the Caucasus. And in the Middle East, an Arab revolt from 1916 onwards, greatly abetted by the British and French, keen to advance their imperialist interests, meant that Ottoman administration scarcely functioned in the southern part of the empire. In the Turkish heartlands, meanwhile, the problems were mounting alarmingly. Losses at the front were massive. Estimates put Turkish deaths as high as 2.5 million, 3 times those of Britain. The scale of such losses, accompanied at home by a collapsing currency, soaring prices, and acute shortages of food and other commodities, undermined the already tottering foundations of the Ottoman Empire. The armistice brought no end to the suffering and violence in Turkey, which was soon plunged into a war of independence that lasted until 1923, when a wrecked country eventually emerged from the ruins as an independent sovereign state. And the takeover of Ottoman possessions in the Middle East by the Western imperialist powers, Britain and France, was accompanied by huge anti-colonial unrest, waves of protest and endemic violence that equally saw no abrupt break with the end of the war. The consequences for the indefinite future were enormous. The war left behind a Europe broken into pieces, scarcely recognizable from the continent that had entered the conflict 4 years earlier. Even the victorious powers, Britain, France, and, as a nominally victorious, nominally great power, Italy, had been left shattered. Cleaning up the mess seemed most likely to fall to the one emergent great power, physically unscarred by the war and economically massively strengthened as the European powers were enfeebled, the United States. That America eventually left Europe with the task of clearing up its own mess played no small part in the unfolding crisis of the post-war era. But at the root of the catastrophic legacy lay something else. Crucially, out of the ruins of Imperial Germany, the Habsburg monarchy, and Tsarist Russia, an unholy constellation had been created that would have baleful consequences in the coming years. The combination of ethnic nationalism, territorial conflicts and class hatred, now focused in aspiration or in dread on the new force of Bolshevism in Russia, would prove highly explosive. Ethnic nationalism was one of the war's main legacies, and it would be most lethal in precisely those parts of Central and Eastern Europe where mixed ethnic communities had for centuries lived alongside each other, but where new tensions, conflicts and hatreds, engendered in large part by the war, now found expression in bitter disputes over contested borders and divided lands, and where the poisonous hatreds had immeasurably increased due to the new ingredient, Bolshevism's triumph in Russia. Class conflict, most especially in Eastern and Central Europe, overlaid ethnic and territorial animosities to produce a boiling cauldron of violent animosity. This meant that the early post-war years were scarcely years of peace in these parts of the continent, where enormous violence continued unabated. The violence would leave deep enmities that would come to the fore when Europe was eventually plunged into another, even more devastating conflict 20 years later. The war had brought immense, unimaginable human losses. The military dead totaled almost 9 million. The civilian dead, largely caused by mass deportation, famine and disease, close to 6 million. Taking all the belligerents together, as many as 7 million combatants had been captured by the enemy and sometimes spent years in often primitive living conditions in prisoner of war camps, though most were fairly quickly repatriated after the armistice. Victory had ultimately been attained by the combination of greater military power with superior economic resources. But what had it all been for? People's views on this naturally varied hugely, not least in accordance with their own experiences and the fate of their countries. Many on all sides had fought for ideals, often misplaced, but ideals just the same. They included defense of the homeland, national honor and prestige, freedom and civilization, patriotic duty, and, increasingly, national liberation, as well as hopes of a better future. As the 4 years of slaughter drew to a close, the well-known Austrian writer Robert Musil cynically jotted in his diary in 1918, "The war can be reduced to the formula, you die for your ideals, because it's not worth living for them." By that time, probably only a minority among the millions of combatants still cherished the ideals, whatever they were, with which they had entered the war. For many among the legions of conscripted soldiers in Europe's mass armies, there may indeed have been little in terms of abstract idealism to begin with, They often fought because they had no alternative, and for many of these, there had been no point to the slaughter. The poignant words of a Frenchman, written at the Western Front in 1916, shortly before he fell, stand as a proxy for the sentiments of millions of ordinary soldiers in all combatant armies. I ask, hoping to understand this slaughter's purpose. The reply I get is, for the fatherland, but never know the reason why. The carnage had been colossal. The destruction immense. The legacy in a dramatically changed Europe would be profound. The long reckoning was about to begin. Chapter 3. Turbulent Peace. Marshal Ferdinand Foch's view of the Treaty of Versailles. This is not a peace. 'Tis an armistice for 20 years. It was peace, after a fashion, but it often didn't seem it. Huge turbulence, like a tidal wave after an earthquake, followed the war. The seismic upheavals took 5 years to subside. The soldiers returned home to a drastically altered political, social, economic, and ideological landscape. The war had destroyed political systems, ruined economies, divided societies, and opened vistas onto radically utopian visions of a better world. It was labelled the war to end war. Why, then, did it pave the way instead for another, even more devastating conflagration? Why did the hopes of millions for peace and for a better society built on greater freedom and equality so swiftly evaporate? How, instead, did Europe lay the foundations of a dangerously ideological triad of utterly incompatible political systems competing for dominance, communism, fascism, and liberal democracy? Yet why, in these early crisis years and despite the immediate post-war traumas, did communism triumph only in Russia, fascism only in Italy, while democracy survived in most of the remainder of Europe, not least in the country at the pivotal center of the continent, Germany? Lands fit for heroes? During the British election campaign of 1918, the Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, hailed by many as the man who won the war, spoke of making a fit country for heroes to live in. Even in what had before the war been Europe's richest country, and one left physically almost entirely undamaged by 4 years of fighting, the words would soon seem no more than a hollow mockery to many soldiers who had come home from the trenches. Early demobilization of the soldiers in Britain had in fact been fairly smooth. From 3.5 million at the armistice in 1918, the army fell in size to 370,000 men by 1920. An immediate post-war economic boom meant that by the summer of 1919, four-fifths of the soldiers had been discharged, and most of those had found work, sometimes at the expense of women employed during the war. But the boom ended as quickly as it had begun. By the autumn of 1920, it was over. Deflationary policies following those in the USA, introduced to protect sterling, had a drastic effect on living standards. Wages, which had initially kept up with rising prices, fell sharply. Class tensions remained high. In 1919, 35 million days had been lost in industrial disputes. In 1921, the figure was 86 million. Unemployment doubled over the 3 months from December 1920 to March 1921. By the summer, 2 million were without work. Most of the unemployed lived in squalid, dilapidated accommodation. Homes for heroes had been promised in 1918, but by 1923, 822,000 new houses were needed just to cover the basic housing shortage, greater than in 1919, let alone replace millions of desolate slum dwellings. By 1921, countless former soldiers, many of them badly disabled, were living in dire poverty, begging on the streets or trying to eke out a living by selling matches and mementos, eating at food kitchens, sometimes forced to sleep in doorways or on park benches. "We were no longer heroes. We were simply unemployed," was one former officer's bitter commentary. Ex-servicemen were continually coming to the door, selling bootlaces and asking for cast-off shirts and socks, remembered Robert Graves, poet, writer, and former frontline officer. Patriots, especially of the female variety, were as much discredited in 1919 as in 1914 they had been honoured, recalled Vera Brittain, who had left a comfortable upper-middle-class background and volunteered to nurse the wounded at the front. She saw a world denuded of prospects and left arid and pointless. The situation in Britain, dismal though it was far from the worst in Europe, certainly among the countries directly involved in the fighting. Terrible though they were, the British casualties fell below the highest rates. The United Kingdom's military dead numbered 750,000, a further 180,000 dead from across the empire. Italy's almost 500,000, France's 1.3 million, Austria-Hungary's almost 1.5 million, Russia's around 1.8 million, Germany's just over 2 million. Some of the smaller countries suffered worst in proportionate terms. One in three Serbs and Romanians sent into battle was killed or died of injuries or disease. The proportion of the dead among the fighting troops from the major belligerent countries ranged between 11 to 12%, Russia, Italy, and the United Kingdom, and 15 to 16%, France, Germany, and Austria-Hungary. The wounded, disabled, and incapacitated greatly outnumbered the dead in all countries. The overall death toll was more than twice as high as the combined total from all major wars between 1790 and 1914. The influenza epidemic of 1918 to 19 then caused deaths worldwide twice as high as those on European battlefields during the war. To add to the horrific toll were the victims of related post-war violence and border conflicts. The economic cost of the war was immense. Over six times the total of all countries' national debt from the end of the 18th century until 1914. In countries most directly affected by the fighting, production after the war was drastically reduced from what it had been in 1913. The United Kingdom, by contrast, fared much better. Its government indebtedness, even so, was nearly 12 times higher in 1918 than it had been in 1914. And its total net debt to the United States, the highest among the Allies, standing at nearly $4.5 billion by 1922, now meant, as for most of Europe, lasting dependence on credit from the USA. Neutral countries were also economically buffeted by the war. Mostly, like Sweden, they had been able to expand their economies to cope with wartime demands. The impact on neutral Spain, however, was to intensify its economic problems and to deepen the social, ideological, and political fissures already present in the country. In Western Europe, physical devastation from the war was largely confined to Belgium and northeast France. These battleground regions suffered grievously. Hundreds of thousands of houses had been destroyed. Industry was extensively damaged. Vast acreages of land were left unfit to till, and a large proportion of livestock had been killed. The worst affected areas were, however, no more than 30 to 60 kilometres wide. Beyond the fighting zone, France, along with the rest of Western Europe, suffered remarkably little destruction. In the east, where the war had been more mobile, it was a different story. Serbia, Poland, and the regions that would become Belarus and Ukraine, trampled on and ravaged by advancing and retreating armies, underwent extreme devastation. Victorious soldiers going home into a hero's welcome in London at least found a country recognizable from the one they had left. Soldiers returning, often in disarray, to Vienna, Budapest, Munich, or Berlin were, in contrast, plunged into revolutionary upheaval and economic chaos. Oddly, defeated Germany coped better than victorious Britain, or for that matter, neutral Holland, in managing the post-war labour market and keeping down unemployment, partly by forcing women out of their jobs they had entered during the war and replacing them by men. Inflation, too, helped. Deflationary economics at this point would have wrecked the German economy still further and made it impossible to find jobs for so many ex-soldiers. The rampant inflation that the government did nothing to curb was, however, a price which would soon be paid in other seriously damaging ways. Inflation had gathered pace in Germany during the war, when the national debt rose almost 30-fold, paper money in circulation over 20-fold. Prices were about 5 times higher in 1918 than they had been before the war, and the currency had lost about half of its earlier value. Germany wasn't alone. Austria-Hungary's wartime inflation and currency depreciation were even greater. Most countries experienced inflation on some level during the war. Prices were 3 times higher in 1919 than they had been in 1913 in France, the Netherlands, Italy, and the Scandinavian countries. Almost 2.5 times as high in the United Kingdom. Especially in Central and Eastern Europe, however, price inflation galloped out of control in the post-war years. In Poland, Austria, and Russia, the currency was ruined amid hyperinflation. Jan Słomka, whom we met in Chapter 2, for many years the mayor of the village of Żyków in southeastern Poland, recalled a few years later the impact of the rampaging inflation after the Austrian crown had been replaced by the Polish paper mark in 1920. If anyone sold anything and didn't at once buy something else with the money, he would lose heavily. There were many who sold house or field or part of their cattle, only to keep their money either at home or in some bank. These lost all they had and became beggars. On the other hand, those who borrowed money and bought things with it made fortunes. There were endless heaps of money. One had to carry it in briefcases or baskets. Purses and the like were useless. For things for the house, one paid in thousands, then in millions, and finally in billions. Only the introduction in 1924 of an entirely new currency, the zloty, produced stabilization in Poland. In Germany, the descent into hyperinflation was part of the grave political crisis that gripped the country in 1923 after the French, retaliating for German defaults on reparations payments, had occupied the Ruhr industrial heartlands. But the roots of the hyperinflation lay in war financing, based on the gamble that Germany would win the war and recoup its costs from the defeated countries. The economic consequences of the defeat then offered little incentive to Germany to prevent inflation. The German war effort had been mainly financed by domestic war loans. Inflation offered the means to liquidate these domestic debts. Early post-war measures to check rising prices gave way once the reparations bill, which could only be paid in gold marks, not depreciated currency, was known in 1921, to a strategic readiness to accept high inflation. As well as paying off domestic debts and staving off serious labour militancy that deflationary measures had prompted, for example, in Britain, inflation helped German industry to make a quick recovery after the war and gave a major boost to German exports. Industrialists could borrow what they needed for investment and repay the loans in depreciated currency. And as the German currency lost value, goods could be exported at highly competitive prices. It was little wonder that Germany experienced enormous growth in industrial production and shrinking unemployment between 1920 and 1922, at a time when deflationary policies in the USA, Britain, and France saw exactly the reverse, falling rates of production and rising unemployment.